This is Ozarks at Large. Late last semester, the University of Arkansas School of Law invited Richard Sander, a law professor from UCLA, to speak on campus. Sander is the author of several controversial articles, editorials, and a book about what he calls the failure of affirmative action on college campuses throughout the country. Sander, with degrees from Harvard and Northwestern, researches questions of social and economic equality. His latest book regarding affirmative action is titled Mismatch: How Affirmative Action Hurts Students It's Intended to Help and Why Universities Won't Admit It. During his time in Northwest Arkansas this fall, Richard Sander came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk to me about his research and opinions, about the protests and criticisms leveled against him, and about his book. I asked him about a word he used in the title, mismatch.
It's capturing the idea that there's an optimal learning environment for any student, and that is where you're at a school where the median student is someone not too far from you in academic preparation. And it's possible to have both a positive and a negative mismatch. If you go to a school, suppose you go to a community college and you actually want to be a rocket scientist, you'd be positively mismatched because the teachers would not be covering material that's challenging to you. Negative mismatch occurs when you go to a school that is mostly inhabited by students who have stronger academic preparation. The teacher is probably teaching to them and not you, and that can lead to less learning.
You have used the example that perhaps a student who is entering a fine school might be mismatched if they're entering a perhaps more competitive school.
That's right.
I read in The Atlantic an adaptation from the book, you use maybe Richmond, but you find yourself at Duke. You say that affirmative action has created this mismatch, especially for young students of color.
Right. Mismatch is something that can happen to anyone. It's not purely a racial phenomenon. And we certainly use preferences in schools for athletes and for legacy students and all sorts of reasons. But we use particularly large preferences for African Americans and sometimes for Hispanics. And they're sufficiently pervasive that they really affect the overall educational outcomes of those groups.
The argument that this mismatch is doing nobody any good, that you're actually a good intention, you would argue, is actually hurting the people, the students, the young men and women who perhaps it was designed to help.
That's right. And it's important to keep in mind, not only is this not limited to race, but it's also not an argument about whether students should go to college. There's a tremendous range of college in the U.S. And African Americans currently are about 30% more likely to go to a four-year college than whites with similar credentials and academic background. So it's not fundamentally a question of access. It's a question of trying to maximize how effective that college education is. Because even though blacks are more likely to start college, they're about 30% less likely to end up with a degree than comparable white students. And this is even more true in areas like science and engineering, where mismatch seems to have a particularly powerful effect. So we're investing a lot of resources. We've done a lot to open access, but we haven't done a very good job of sort of optimizing the educational outcomes for blacks and Hispanics who get into college.
Don't let me put words in your mouth. But the idea being here that some of the schools that have affirmative action are taking students who perhaps have not been as prepared as other students that they'll be sitting by at that college or university.
Right. So let's take law school, for example. We admit about – currently American Legal Education admits about 4,000 blacks a year. There are about 200 law schools. Blacks have a bar failure rate that's about four times as high as it is for whites. And part of that is because many blacks are coming in with just weaker academic preparation from college to high school. But about half of that bar passage gap, we think, is due to mismatch and could be eliminated by better allocating black students across schools. So elite schools seek diversity. They want to expand opportunity. They use aggressive preferences to try to admit students who don't necessarily do well. And they also then change the behavior of every other law school because those law schools, if they want diversity, now have to admit students that are less academically prepared too because the students that would fit well at their school have been admitted by a more elite school. So University of Arkansas needs to use preferences partly because blacks who are highly qualified to do extremely well here are being competed for by national universities.
Let me play devil's advocate a bit. Okay. This may mean then that the best schools continue at this point for a number of reasons to have a large amount of white affluent students. And doesn't that just continue that? Because I'm a University of Arkansas alum, and we're proud of the education we get here. But let's face it, if I'm up against a Harvard grad or a Duke grad or a UCLA grad, all things being even, those grads will get a job before me. So isn't it perpetuating this sort of elite system?
Well, there are two answers to that, maybe even more. But let me give you two. One is that when we talk about eliteness, we tend to sort of make white and Asian synonymous with eliteness. And the way preferences work these days, it's really leaves socioeconomic disadvantage out of the equation. The great majority of students who receive preferences into the elite schools, regardless of the race, are upper middle class. So we're not really creating the kind of pathway to opportunity that we think we are and that we were back in the 1970s and 80s. Affirmative action has become much more homogeneous in terms of the basic eliteness of the students affected. The second thing is that all things are not equal when you're competing with a more elite student because you have to think about how you're going to perform at that school. So if you go to a school where you receive a large preference, you're probably going to have lower grades. And if you have less learning as well, that affects your competitiveness in the job market too. So we've done research. Most of my research has been on law graduates on this particular question. But if you kind of compare law graduates who came into law school with similar inputs and then graduate and they do pass the bar, they get past that type of mismatch and they're competing on the job market, and you look at what's sort of the outcome of a high GPA student at a middle tier school versus a low GPA student at a higher tier school, the grades really do seem to trump the eliteness. You seem to generally be better off being a high GPA student. So much so that the head of the National Association of Law Placement recently changed the advice that they give to graduates and urged people to start paying attention to the relative position a student will have when they go to law school.
When affirmative action began in the 1960s and 1970s, it was an idea that would foster equality, right? The little, if any, argument that there was a disparity. Did it work in its infancy, in its beginnings?
It was working pretty well in its beginnings. And part of the idea was that affirmative action has to open doors that have been closed, and it has to get us to rethink kind of our qualification systems. And that did happen. You know, there were a lot of schools that colleges were not recruiting at when affirmative action started. And it got admissions officers to really think in terms of a larger box. So I think those early efforts were quite effective in increasing inclusion. The premise of a lot of those early efforts was that we need to jumpstart race preferences now because, this was in the late 1960s and a lot of campuses seemed very illegitimate to their own students and to society. They seemed too much like bastions of privilege. So they said, well, we'll jumpstart this. And as educational disparities even out in American society, the need for these preferences will go away. And there was tremendous progress made in the 70s and 80s in the black-white test score gap, for example. Minorities really did start doing dramatically better in high school. The number of high school graduates from minority populations went way up. But around 1990, progress in the test score gap really slowed down and eventually stopped. So schools that thought that they would be long past preference systems by the year 2000 still found themselves very dependent on that. And that was also when the shift to focusing on more elite subpopulations within minority groups happened as well. So affirmative action sort of became more institutionalized, and at the same time it became less moored to its original goal of really trying to open up doors that have been closed.
It seems we're talking about a much bigger problem, about the ability to get as many students ready for higher education as we can, that there's still a gap in the readiness. And again, it's perhaps a socioeconomic or a regional factor.
The interesting thing is that you can make a pretty good argument that our current preference system has allowed us to ignore this underlying problem you're talking about, which is the test score gap and why the K-12 system is not eliminating that gap. And that argument picks up a lot of support when you look at what's happened in states that have banned racial preferences. California was the first in 1996.
They're Prop 209?
Yeah, that's right. There are now 7 or 8 states that have done things like Prop 209. And Richard Kallenberg at the Century Foundation recently released a report where he showed that in almost every one of those states, universities started really focusing on the K-12 system after the bans went into effect. I saw this myself in California. The University of California started spending tens of millions of dollars on K-12 partnerships that actually worked. They actually got a lot more students into the pipeline because preferences can be a very easy, sort of a very painless way for a university to achieve diversity in freshman numbers. But it's not really either dealing with the fundamental problem in the pipeline, nor is it really maximizing the educational outcomes of students. So one thing that a racial ban can do is it can focus more attention on the K-12 pipeline.
So instead of a shiny coat of paint, you can actually work on the whatever is under that paint and try to strengthen it.
Yeah, the other thing that I think we really need, and racial bans have some other pretty unattractive consequences. Something we really need is transparency, and that will get the university's focus on the outcome side. Right now, there's no law school in the country, for example, that tells students how their credentials relate to their performance in the bar exam. So many students go to law schools where the law school knows that they only have a 40 or 50% chance of passing the bar. But the school-wide rate is, say, 85 or 90%. And that's the only thing that student can find out about. So the students can't use self-help to sort of figure out how can I avoid the mismatch problem. There just isn't any information to do it. If the schools provide that information, students would be more empowered. And I think the schools would be under a lot more pressure to try to fix the problems. They might change their admissions. They might develop academic support programs to improve outcomes. But right now they're able to essentially hide beneath the diversity program.
If that's the case, and I'm a university that has that sort of those figures, I'm not exactly 100% interested in having more transparency necessarily.
Yeah, it's never going to come, at least not in my lifetime, from universities deciding to suddenly do this. There's some chance that the Supreme Court will mandate more transparency in the affirmative action case that's before the court this term. There's also a lot of discussion. There's a growing consensus, I think, among thoughtful critics of the preference system that transparency is needed.
You and your co-author Stuart Taylor Jr. have, one of you or both of you have written that this is kind of the third rail. No one wants to touch this in academia.
Yeah, university administrators have realized that that wading into the merits of preferences is the surest road to retirement. I get lots of fan mail from retired administrators, former administrators, who say, keep up the good fight. But present administrators almost never want to talk about this. So pressure for change has to come from the outside. Maybe it's the court. Maybe it's legislators. Civil Rights Commission has issued 2 reports calling for Congress to mandate more transparency. But a lot of politicians see this as a third rail, too. So it's not clear where reform will come, but there's certainly growing sentiment for it.
You mentioned you get fan mail. Imagine occasionally something crosses your desk that qualifies as something other than fan mail.
Occasionally. There was a near riot at UCLA a couple of weeks ago about part of my book, which found that that UCLA had covertly reinstituted racial preferences.
Which would be against state law.
That's correct. Because of Prop 209. And I was pointing out that there had been so much pressure on the university to try to get freshman numbers back to pre-209 levels, and so much reluctance by the university to point out how dramatically better graduation rates were since race neutrality started, that the students were quite upset. And the university, in response to my book, said, we're not going to change anything that we're doing. They didn't try to prove that what they were doing was legal. They just said, don't worry, we're not making any change to it. But interestingly, the student paper on campus really tried to get a dialogue going. And And students who were initially pretty upset really started thinking about what's going on. And there's a diversity group on campus that's arranged for a big forum next week at UCLA. So I think that I think if people get enough information about the underlying facts, one can change the politics of this a little bit.
Finally, when you think of certain flash issues, hot button issues, gay marriage, abortion, some of these others, they're generally, with a broad brush, is this left versus right, liberal versus conservative. Often, when you mention affirmative action, that broad brush gets painted there. Is that fair, and can we make progress if that sort of short opinion exists?
It's tough. I think the left-right divide has dominated the affirmative action debate really since the 1970s, where the left says equal opportunity means trying to get results that are relatively similar across groups, and the right says equal opportunity means being completely colorblind, right? So the debate has been in that rut for a long time. And what's happened in the last 10 years, not just from my work, but really from 20 or 30 other scholars collectively, is more of a focus on the empiricism and saying, let's actually think about what works. And if you do that, it takes it out of the ideological box, because you're then saying we have a limited amount of political capital that we can spend on good efforts to try to help achieve better racial results, better racial equality in America. Let's try to put that in areas where it's actually going to have an effect. Let's not invest political capital in areas where we may be doing things that are counterproductive. So that sort of logic, and I think shifting the focus towards socioeconomic diversity, towards K-12 improvement, all those things I think can really reconfigure many aspects of the affirmative action debate into one where progressives should be coalescing around this critical opinion.
Is there a website where people can learn more about the book?
Yes. There's something called Project SEAPHE, S-E-A-P-H-E, that has a lot of information about it and related research.
Richard Sander, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Richard Sander is a law professor at UCLA and a co-founder of the program in Public Interest Law and Policy. He is also the author of the book Mismatch: How Affirmative Action Hurts Students It's Intended to Help and Why Universities Won't Admit It. He spoke on the University of Arkansas campus late last semester, and during his time in Northwest Arkansas, he came to our studios for our conversation. This is Ozarks at Large.
On the next Fresh Air, Gene Robinson reflects on his time as the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church. He's just retired. For years, Robinson received death threats. One suspect was arrested with photos of Robinson.
He had scrawled across them, "Save the church, kill the bishop," and he had a sawed-off shotgun and tons of ammunition.
Join us.
Fresh Air with Terry Gross, tonight at 6 on KUAF 91.3 FM.